You're listening to the Roundtable Podcast, episode 33.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robinson.
And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast.
Each week on the Roundtable Podcast, we invite writers to come on the show and pitch a story idea to us and our esteemed guest host.
And then we dig into it. Sorry, I was about to say spread it all over our bodies, but no, I couldn't go there. All right, so then we dig into it, talking about what works, what doesn't, kick around some ideas. We don't spread it all over our bodies
because that's just
a terrible image. And try and fine-tune it into a solid and writable story, something that we love to call...
Oh, God, literary gold.
Literary gold, right. And like, you don't want to rub that all over your body because then you chafe.
Well, I'm thinking of James Bond, you know, I'm thinking Auric Goldfinger, you know.
There it's you like, go.
Ooh, yeah, we're going to rub...
I'm thinking of...
We'll be Storyfinger. We can be Storyfinger, we'll rub stories.
Storyfinger, there you go. No, I was picturing Donald Duck's uncle...
Oh, Scrooge McDuck
diving into the gold. And I saw a picture somewhere where like somebody tries it and then their bones are all broken and sticking out of their
sure,
skin.
Sure, because gold is heavy.
Yeah, let's move on. That.
Actually, I wanted to share something real quick.
Yes.
I was listening to Scott Roche's Secret Project podcast today on my way into work, and I discovered a fabulous new podcast.
Really?
And I have got to share this. It's called Crucible of Realms.
Ooh.
And these guys, they do what we do, Brian, only they do it with worlds.
Ooh, cool.
So somebody will come in with a story idea. The one I listened to today was let's hypothesize a world where genetic engineering has gone so far that we've been able to completely eliminate all genetic diseases, all pathologies related to genetics, everything is totally mappable and controllable by the genetic scientists. And what that would do to the world. And they project ahead like maybe 1,000, 2,000 years. So it's a sci-fi setting. And they riff on this thing for like an hour. And dude, it's amazing.
That's awesome.
It is. It's fat. I can't wait to dig into the other episodes. It's crucibleofrealms.com, friends. And if you really dig the story workshopping that we do, then you might want to check this out just because from a creative standpoint, it's fabulous. You're sitting there shouting at the screen saying, yeah, but don't, what about this? What about this? Just like you do with our podcast. So it's awesome.
At least that's what we hope they do.
Oh, you know, they do. You know,
of course they do. So do they just focus on the world building part of it?
Well, it's world building. And there's also a concept of story arc. I mean, that's kind of in there, but it's more from a gamer's perspective, I think, more than a storytelling perspective. But really the distinction between the two is a very fine line.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But it feels like they're building something that you could set game adventures in, but it could also be for storytelling. I mean, I was listening to theirs and I'm going, holy crap, I could totally write this. This would be a 4-book series. Yeah, it's huge.
Right. So right. And the cool thing about that is that if they're, you know, once people start riffing on what's going on in a world, you just got to tweak 2 or 3 things and it's yours.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Just
which
like
is awesome.
We're doing here. So
yeah. Yeah.
So check that out, friends. But for now, let's continue on with the cycle, the process of the round table, which leads us gracefully into welcoming back our guest host. He is the author of the Solar Clipper series and the Tanith Fairport novels, recognized with numerous Parsecs and Parsec finalists, Patio Books, Founders Choice Awards. So dear friends, please welcome back to the big chair at the round table, Mr. Nathan Lowell. Nathan,
Yay! Thank
you. Yay! It's awesome. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you very much.
You are very welcome. The world continues to evolve and change in the world of Lowell. And I'm personally really intrigued to hear this next segment, which is what's coming next for Nathan Lowell? What do fans of Nathan Lowell need to know about that's coming up in the next few months or years?
Well, we're going to get the Zephyr's Call out.
Yay.
And right behind that should come the Hermit of Lammas Wood. I'm hoping that those both are all going to be out by the end of the year.
Oh, wow.
The last two books of the Share series are supposed to see publication by year's end. You know, that's as far out as I can really
Okay.
So really look too far down the road. I'm hoping to do 6 books next year. We'll see if that works.
Wow.
And where are these books going to take place?
Well, at least 3 of them are going to be new Ishmael Wong stories. Okay. I still owe fans Cape Grace, which is the bridge work that goes between South Coast and Half Share. Another shaman's tale. And then there's some more work that I want to do in the Odin's Outpost portion of the universe.
Okay.
And I really would like to do something new, something different, something strange, something odd.
Yeah. Any ideas?
No, not yet, but I have some characters who have been knocking on my door, and I may have to open it.
Very cool. We will look forward to seeing who's on the other side.
Absolutely. Well,
what about conventions? Any conventions that are coming up for you?
Balticon, always.
Always.
Always. And then, let's see, there's one here in Denver, Mile High Con. I just got my invite for that. I'll be on some panels there.
Sweet.
And probably Cosign. In January, down in Colorado Springs, I'll be going down there probably.
Okay.
For that, in January, I'm waiting to hear from the organizers down there to see how that's gonna play out. They had their hotel had either a change of hands or going out of business or something, so they needed to find a new venue this year.
Okay.
And I haven't heard yet what the outcome of that is, but yeah, I'm in theory Cosign in January.
Is Cosign a sci-fi fantasy con?
Yeah, it's a small local con down in Colorado Springs at the foot of Pikes Peak. It's very, weekend kind of thing.
Cool. And that's in January.
End of January, beginning of February, someplace like that. Yeah.
Brian.
Cool. I know. I already wrote it down.
Excellent.
It's not during graduation or finals week. So.
See?
That's right. So
see?
I don't have any more excuses.
None.
Other than the fact that I will have like a 3-month-old baby.
Well, so yes, besides
what,
that.
How much that counts.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you'll have incurred enough daddy karma that you'll be able to be unleashed for a weekend.
That's right. Yeah.
We'll hope. We'll just hope. Awesome. Well, very cool, Nathan. That sounds like something I think we can all get behind. More books from Nathan Lowell, more appearances from Nathan Lowell. That's very cool. Well, gentlemen, I hate to rush this along, but I'm eager. I'm chomping at the bit.
Yes.
I would love to sit down and start workshopping a story. What do you say?
Let's do it, yeah.
Yes. All right. Before we do, we're going to pause for a brief promotional break, share some airtime with another awesome podcast or a fabulous book that is making its way to the podosphere or to print or who knows. But when we come back, we'll workshop a story. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Scott Roche, and I've always been a huge fan of Westerns. I've watched everything from Stagecoach to Posse. I've tried my hand at writing a few, always looking to bring my own perspective to the genre, and I've finally done it. I'm marrying the things I love best about the Western to another passion of mine, samurai. Imagine the gunslingers of the Old West with an honor code similar to the samurai's Bushido, the way of the warrior. The Way of the Gun, a Bushido Western anthology, will tackle that very concept. The stories will have all of the action and adventure that you'd expect from a Sunday matinee shoot-'em-up with a dash of philosophy and tension as an ancient code deals with an increasingly modern world. I'll be joined in this anthology of short stories by some of my favorite authors. Jake Bible, the mind behind Dead Mech and the Americans, Justin McCumber, author of the military sci-fi novel Haywire, Zach Ricks, editor of Flagship Magazine and the author of his own weird Western series, Jared Axelrod, creator of the rich world behind Fables of the Flying City, and Doc Coleman, podcaster and author of the steampunk series Crackle and Bang. If you're as excited about the idea as I am, go to kickstarter.scottroche.com and you can find out more. Thanks, and we'll see you on the internet.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. And I honestly don't want to waste any time trying to come up with something clever to say right here, because this is going to be a badass workshop that we're doing. So let's just go right into it.
Let's, by all means, because we can't really do a workshop without a courageous and creative writer stepping up to the plate and offering up a story for us to rub all over our bodies. I can't get that image out of my mind. Oh, my God.
Is that before or after it's the gold?
Yeah, yeah. Either way, maybe it's transformed during. Who knows?
Ooh.
But our guest writer...
That's why it becomes gold.
Exactly. Our guest writer this week has been writing since he was 13, and like so many of us, he has no problem starting a tale, but finds that finishing that tale is another matter entirely. And Brian, there are three qualities of our guest writer that will endear you to him.
And what are those three qualities, Dave?
One, when the economy tanked and corporations started to turn snarky and nasty, he politely told them to go screw themselves, and I paraphrase, and started his own company that has sustained him and his family to this day. Two, he studied theater. Oh, what a shock. Oh, and film in high school, including producing a short piece for their film class titled Mutant Rat, about the titular rat mutating to Chuck E. Cheese size and running down victims in a beat-up Camaro, which personally
that's
I believe
awesome.
That's destined to be a cult classic someday.
Absolutely.
Yes. And he pursues and excels at mixed martial arts, including Taekwondo, Capoeira, I had to practice that one, and three others that I absolutely cannot pronounce. He's fought in competition. He's trained with professional mixed martial artist cage fighters and has assumed positions of leadership and responsibilities where he's training kids and adults in this dynamic martial arts form. And, Brian, he may be our very first listener.
I think you're right.
I think I'm right. So please welcome to the writer's chair at the round table, Mr. Michael Brudenell. Mike, thank you so much for stepping up and offering a story, man.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a real honor.
Absolutely. Now, Mike, you shared with me a story about how you got drawn into fantasy and sci-fi. And I was wondering, would you be willing to share that with our audience?
Yeah, absolutely. I started, like most kids, you know, reading The Hobbit and Chronicles of Narnia, back in, maybe 81, 82. But in 83, my father passed away. And when that happened, I had to, deal with it. And one of the things I did is I decided I was going to read everything that he had in his library. And he was reading Tolkien, of course, Lord of the Rings, but also had Donaldson, Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, The Unbeliever, L. Ron Hubbard, and Robert Heinlein. So I dug in, and at 12 years old, I was reading Chronicles of Thomas Holy Covenant, shit. The Unbeliever, which really opened my eyes to fantasy and the worlds that it could bring me to.
Sure.
And it helped me understand my father, which was important to me.
Yeah. I can only imagine a 12-year-old trying to wrap his head around the concept of the anti-hero.
Yeah. And back to the introduction, I have one correction to make. I have not actually competed.
Really?
I started mixed martial arts when I was just about turning 40. So my wife forbade me from competition in the cage. So while I was accepted onto the competition team, I helped train and prepare our fighters for the cage.
Very good.
But I have not stepped in other than for, friendly bouts with my fellow partners in fighting, but I have not done it myself.
Okay, all right, very good. That that's important. That's an important distinction. But you were accepted onto the competition team after auditioning,
correct.
Right?
Yeah, a very arduous test of skill, endurance, and tenacity.
Okay. Well, and that's actually a good transition, because we're going to test that tenacity as we dive into the next segment, which is the story that you brought for the workshop, yes?
Absolutely.
Excellent. So, Mike, here's the deal. We're going to give you 5 to 8 minutes. Give us title, genre, format, whether it's going to be a novel, series of short stories, whatever. Introduce us to the world, the characters. Give us some basic signpost arcs of the story. And we'll take it from there. So, sir, the mic is all yours.
Thank you very much, sir. Okay, so the story is titled The Keepers of Chi. It's an adventure story with a little alternate history spiced with magical realism. It can be a novel, but from the beginning, I've envisioned it as a serialized set of novellas that would tell a long-form story through a series of episodes. The series would all be titled The Keepers of Chi, with the first episode being titled Finding the Way. I want to self-publish, and I'm very interested in podcasting it as well. For an elevator pitch, it's Mortal Kombat meets Bourne Identity. Here's the hook. After deciding never to fight again, an outcast cage fighter must learn to control his preternatural martial arts abilities, evade capture from government special forces, and survive rogue super soldiers, all before the true enemy destroys us all. The theme is betrayal of trust, forgiveness, and acceptance, and learning to trust again. Also, accepting a greater responsibility other than only caring about ourselves. The story is set in our contemporary world. It begins in Las Vegas, but will have scenes that range from several cities in the U.S. to the remote mountains of Tibet. My protagonist is Benny the Paladin Parker. A professional cage fighter, Benny is an amazingly gifted martial artist with a strong sense of right and wrong, but he is also arrogant and has difficulty trusting others. Benny was training in the martial arts at an early age, and then at the age of 12, his older brother was killed in gang violence. Because of this tragedy, Benny hates violence. But because of his love for martial arts, he builds a wall of conflicting distinctions between martial arts for competition and what he sees as true violence. In the beginning of the story, Benny is fighting to be the top title contender when his burgeoning power bursts forth. Unable to control it, he inadvertently kills his opponent. At the beginning of the story, Benny would like nothing better than to quit his fighting career and disappear into obscurity. However, the power that has caused his inner turmoil is also a beacon that has made him a target. There to help Benny is Laura Acevedo. Laura is Benny's girlfriend. A recent love interest, Benny was attracted to Laura because of her own martial art abilities. However, because of Benny's power surfacing, Laura reveals to Benny that she is a member of a group of martial artists from all over the world who share his power. An initiate of the Keepers of Chi, she was assigned to watch him and help him once his powers were revealed. The Keepers of Chi want to teach Benny how to control his abilities. Angered by what Benny sees as deceit for not telling him about her mission, he rails against her offer of help. Helping Laura is Shun. Shun is a master of Kung Fu and the leader of the Keepers of Chi. Here are my antagonists. In the beginning, Laura acts as a minor antagonist to Benny because his main goal is to hide. He doesn't want to be part of the Keepers. He is forced to follow her to survive and sees the need to learn to control his abilities to the point that he can hide from those that would use him. Matt Jones is Benny's fight manager. Matt is a military man, covert ops veteran, who now works in the martial arts world as a scout for the same shadow organizations trying to obtain Benny. Matt has several fighters he manages, and there are hundreds of these scouts around the world. Once Benny's abilities surface, Matt's goal is to become Benny's handler and bring him to the government for testing and programming, similar to the fabled, infamous Monarch programming. Matt's motivation is less about patriotism and now about financial gain. He knows he will be rewarded if he brings in a legitimate candidate. Captain Jack Shaw is Matt's contact and handler for the Black Ops team tasked with procuring gifted fighters for the military super soldier program. Captain Shaw is motivated by the loss of his son to combat and a desire to protect future soldiers. He feels that if a few are hurt to create an unstoppable soldier, that the end will justify the means. Behind the Black Ops teams and super soldier program is also a race of interdimensional beings. These beings have developed over hundreds of millennia to feed off of life energy. They fed to the point of destroying their own world and now travel to other worlds in order to sustain their existence. They have been feeding off our world for years and working towards a mass siphoning of all life energy on our world. They can sense the Keepers, but the Keepers' control of their abilities obfuscates the creatures' attempts to locate them. A quick backstory. Before we get into the basic outline, I'd like to go over a little bit into the Keepers of Chi. I look at this as a little bit of alternate history, but actual records are more rumor and legend than actual fact. The Keepers of Chi is an organization of martial artists from around the world and comprise nearly all styles of martial arts. The Keepers of Chi originated after the destruction of the Shaolin Temple during the 17th century. It is thought that the temple was destroyed because of the monastery's support of the Ming Dynasty, but the true reason was a manhunt for Yao Zhu Xiang. Yao Zhu was one of the rarest of martial artists, one who could access and use in martial arts the living energy of all things, what the Chinese refer to as Qi. Legends tell of five fugitive monks fleeing the destruction of the temple who brought Shaolin Kung Fu to other parts of China. What is known only by a few is that there was a sixth fugitive monk, Yao Zhu, who traveled out of China and settled in the mountains of Tibet. Yao Zhu built a new monastery and pledged to protect martial arts and, more importantly, Qi. True adepts at the use of living energy are rare, and of the six monks that survived, this monk was the only true adept. Yao Zhu created the Keepers of Qi to seek out other adepts, teach them to control their powers, and defend against those who had used their power for evil. Act 1. The story opens with either Laura leaving the Keeper's Monastery to find Benny or directly with Benny's fight. I'm unsure if I want Laura to start in Tibet and then at the fight already have their romance in the early stages, or if I start directly with Benny's fight. If it starts with Benny's fight, then I could potentially have the romance already started or start during the story. After the accidental death of his opponent, Benny retreats to his hotel room. He is getting repeated calls from reporters and his manager. At this point, Laura comes to the room and convinces Benny to let her in. Romance already established is kind of important here. She quickly tells Benny that he is in danger and that they need to leave immediately. Benny doesn't want to listen and starts getting more upset. Just then, a figure crashes through the door, and they need to fight for their life from a crazed man exhibiting tremendous martial skill, but also a feral, inhuman viciousness. Laura defeats the berserker, and while Benny is in shock, gets him moving. They flee, and thus starts a frenetic cat-and-mouse chase. Laura's goal was to get him to the temple, but this now seems an insurmountable task. Act 2. After many hair-raising fights and escapes, Benny has seen more of Laura's power and courage, but also has seen the ruthless government agents and inhuman berserkers. He decides that he must learn to control Chi, and through his martial arts, use it to help the Keepers. He is still angry with Laura for her deception, but agrees to cooperate. Act 3. In Act 3, Laura and Benny have been unable to find their way to meet Shun, as he travels to the U.S. to meet them and help train Benny to at least be able to protect himself. The beings trying to destroy our world show themselves to the Keepers in an effort to destroy Shun and possibly topple the Keepers. The Keepers are not a military force and have only wanted to protect Chi and the martial artists who connect with its source. These creatures present a threat that they were not prepared or expected to deal with. For the conclusion of finding the way, Benny decides to help organize the Keepers into a force that can protect our world from this threat. Here's what I would like to get out of this workshop. Character development and overall pacing of the story. I would also like to get ideas for Chi. This is basically my magic system. I have ideas for what you can do and can't do, and also the limitations it has on the practitioner. Also ideas for whether the romance between Benny and Laura work. I do want that romance there. I haven't written much romance into my stories before. It's been more kind of the lustful meetings. But in this one, I'm looking for a true romance.
Okay. Awesome. Dude, fabulous pitch. Well done, sir. Very cool. Then we have our task laid before us, and a delicious, delightful task it is. Brian, would you be so kind as to cover our ass and give the disclaimer?
Michael, in the course of this workshop, Nathan and Dave and I will be throwing out a whole bunch of ideas, and a lot of them will be really amazing in our own minds, and some of them may be complete and total shit. You have absolutely every right to use, disuse, completely ignore, or any other synonymous actions, anything that we have to offer, because this is your story.
Absolutely. Well done, sir. Well done.
Thank you.
As is our habit here at the Roundtable, we always lead off the discussion with initial impressions from our guest hosts. So, Nathan, what are your first impressions of Mike's story idea? Any questions of clarification? Initial points to be raised? Start off our discussion, sir.
How good a juggler are you?
Fair.
Okay. Because you got 5 balls in the air here, dude.
Right.
I love this idea. You had me right up until we went to interdimensional beings.
Yeah. Yep.
And at that point I said, what? and that wasn't something that I really wanted to say. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And I think part of it is from the pitch point. It sounds pasted on.
Okay.
Because you've got a great world. What do the interdimensional beings give you?
I kind of felt that it upped the ante and revealed something deeper into this life energy force, more than just, government agents, but something beyond that, that in a nefarious, plan, needed this, we use it, we survive off of it. but something that actually, you know, was going to take this away from us.
Okay. Consider you don't really need that.
Okay.
Because chi, the nature of chi is that those people who can develop chi, who can build their own reservoirs of chi, that's a really nice, neat, as you said, your source of your magic. This is a really cool thing. Yeah. And not only is it cool because it's cool because it's real. It's because every martial artist who studies anything about martial arts, I did Tai Chi for a long time. We know what Qi is. We know how Qi works. We know that Qi flows. We know that it can be drawn in and it can be used for power. And so not only is it this really cool magic thing, it's also, for the people who participate in this world, a very real thing.
Right.
And so this idea that we have interdimensional beings feeding off it, that one kind of went, okay, but I don't really see what it's doing for your story. Because the story of how this guy taps into this inner chi, I mean, it's almost a reboot of Kung Fu, the old TV series.
Right.
Right.
Where this guy who comes from nowhere into the West and does these amazing things. So you get the same sort of vibe, only you've updated it, you've brought it into the now, you've added this other little hidden hook on the Shaolin legend, and that's good stuff.
Yeah.
And you've got the military on one side, you've got this shadow organization that's global on the other side, you've got this guy caught in the middle. I mean, you've got a really, really rich tapestry here to start pulling threads out of. And I think you got a lot of stuff going on, and I'm not sure that the interdimensional beings are adding a lot to it.
Yeah. One thing I should explain about chi in my world is that what we know in martial arts today is kind of a pale comparison. This goes a little bit over the top. Think of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
I'm completely on board with that.
Okay, good, good. I just want, it needs to be clear that this gives practitioners, and it's more rare, than we would have thought of in martial arts in general. It's rare, and it's extremely powerful. Giving
how rare? One in 10,000? One in 1,000? How rare?
I would say possibly like 1 in 100,000 to 1 in 10,000. Extremely rare.
Okay.
Hold.
That still leaves hundreds.
That's a huge number of people.
Yeah, it's thousands.
Yeah, maybe even
people.
1 in 1,000,000. You know, I'm thinking, that the temple in Tibet probably has trained anywhere from, a couple dozen to no more than 100.
Okay, so you're actually talking about something on the order of 1 in 500,000,000.
Sure, okay, yeah.
Unless you factor in that not everybody knows.
Not everyone has tapped into it. And not everyone survives,
Right. So this is good shit. This is very, very good. I mean, because and part of it is this this notion of tying it to what we already know about chi is going to give you a lot of leverage because, oh yeah, we all study about chi, but what we don't know is that there is this level of chi that only the top 1/100th of 1% of practitioners ever even come in contact with.
Right.
Now we're getting into some juicy stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's as far as you really need to go, because that's a story now that people can relate to. And it goes back to something that I say probably too often, is that now it's a story about real people.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And readers are going to respond, I think, better to stories about real people than stories about not real people.
Yeah.
Yep. Those excellent start, Nathan. Thank you. Brian, what you got, man?
Okay, well, Nathan said exactly what I was thinking. And I had it circled and circled interstellar beings. And that was kind of the feel that I had too, was, you know, you had me going and I was like, oh yeah, this is awesome and everything's, you know, and I was totally in it, totally in the world. And then bam, interstellar beings. And I was like, it just made it feel cheap. It made it feel
interdimensional.
Interdimensional. That's very, very different. Yes. Interdimensional.
Yeah. Interdimensional. Buckaroo Banzai.
That's right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Call of Cthulhu.
But you know, I know what it's like when I talk to people about some of my ideas and they go, oh no, that'll never happen. And then I go, well, shit, you know, because like everything that made me excited about it was that thing. So I was sitting here and I'm trying to think of ways that, you know, that if you really, really, really wanted to keep them, a way that you might go about it. And I think one way to keep from having it feel cheap is at, you know, from the very beginning, have it be part of a subtle backdrop, you know, where there's electric storms that nobody can really explain, but it's not a pivotal part of the story right at the beginning, or at least it doesn't seem that way. Mm-hmm. It just is in the backdrop of what's going on. As he steps outside, you know, he's hit with a warm wind and it's a strange warmth in the middle of November, you know, or, you know, dead birds that he sees and kind of wonders about every now and then, but you know, he doesn't have any answers and he moves on very quickly to something else. You know, I don't know, spontaneous combustion or whatever, but something that every piece of it is in direct opposition to the life energy or to chi, you know what I mean?
Right.
And then when the interdimensional beings sort of manifest, it doesn't slap us in the face as hard. We go, oh shit, they've been there the whole time. Or there have been things in the works all along, and now I see that, and I don't feel like it just kind of came in out of nowhere. So that's a possibility. But I do also kind of think that you don't need it, just based on how absolutely awesome the rest of the idea is.
Yeah.
And you know, and there's a reason that the Bourne identity and Bourne supremacy and Bourne, you know, and it just goes on forever because it's fucking intriguing, you know? And so I think that you're kind of hitting on that too. And when you were talking about, you know, you wanted some help with kind of the character arc, I think your main character is one of the most intriguing characters that I've heard of so far in our workshopping, just based on the internal conflict that he has from, you know, his brother being killed, him hating violence, but being, you know, kind of conflicted and, oh, I'm, you know, in this sort of martial arts world, you know, we can fight within the boundaries and it's, you know, it's accepted and everybody's taking on their own role. And then I accidentally kill somebody and what the fuck, you know?
Yeah.
Just that alone to me makes me want to read the whole rest of the book.
Yeah.
That one aspect and how does he reconcile that? And that's it.
Yeah. And that's a pivotal moment for that whole first story.
And actually how he doesn't reconcile that.
Mm. Yeah.
Because the question really isn't how does he reconcile it. The question is how does he live with it being unreconciled?
Right.
That's where the plot tension gets maintained, not just through this story, but through the whole arc.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't resolve that tension until the last time you want to write his story.
Right.
Because that's his story.
But you have to make the readers think that you're going to.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You have to take them right up to the edge and have him walk away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is very cool stuff.
Yeah. I'm definitely open to dropping that. You know, I threw it in because, you know, I love comics. I love those, you know, over the top stories, like, you know, with the Eater of Worlds because this bio Earth energy system where they pull chi from seemed kind of like an untapped resource, like an energy resource of our world that would be sought after. It would be something that would be almost unable to pass up, you know, to other intelligent beings. Either I said interdimensional because I think that, you can build a reason of how they get here other than, you know, maybe interstellar travel, which obviously wormholes are something to use for that. But I wanted to go kind of something different than that. Well, but it can be dropped or I'll think of different ways to make it more believable. But my true story is about Benny. It's about Benny and it's about his path. You know, like Nathan, I really love how you mentioned Kung Fu because I loved that growing up. His path.
Mike, you raised a good point there that it is a resource that people would be hungry for once it was proven to exist. And I think that's the question. Something has catalyzed events that has led to the story that's unfolding where the government is aware of chi.
Right.
For thousands of years, you know, the Shaolin monks have lived in mystery and shadowy science and shadows in the caves and so on, practicing their mystical arts in secret. But something happened somewhere that spilled the beans that basically corrupted or violated that faith.
Okay, I want to throw something at you guys.
Okay.
Because at the end of this story, I had thought that one of kind of the catalysts for the final scenes would be that this energy, this chi, it would be kind of opened for all of us. Okay. And kind of almost be a unifying kind of let's heal the rift between humanity that keeps us killing each other. And it happens for a brief moment. And that kind of ends things, but then it pulls away, that we can't hold on to it. That those who, you know, aren't adepts, you know, they touch it for a moment. And it's like this fleeting moment in a dream. And then it's gone.
It's a rapture. It's
epiphany. A rapture, exactly. Exactly. But what if that is a catalyst moment for, you know, kind of saying, hey, we're out here. This energy is here. So up until that point, it's hidden to you know, everyone. And then maybe this is something to build on in future stories.
Sure.
Possibly.
Well, one thing that struck me was that, and I'm kind of going to fall on the same side as Nathan and basically Brian in saying that I like the story of Benny and Laura and Shun. And it also reminds me of the Destroyer series, not as campy, but the whole Remo Williams movie that Fred Ward was in.
Oh, yeah. Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins.
Yes, exactly. And that's, you know, that's way out there and not thematically what we're talking about, but there's still that master who knows the secrets, who is teaching the student. But it occurs to me that chi is, while we as humans tend to ascribe this very gentle, light, and good morality to chi, it's not. It doesn't have an inherent moral tone. It's not good, it's not bad, it is. And it's really what you do with it that assigns a flavor or an ethical or moral taint or shine to it. So if you're looking for that kind of, and again, I don't want to keep putting out this big black and white evil and good thing, but the notion of someone who is taking that chi and applying it in a way that is not supportive of life, for example.
Yeah.
A corrupter of the promise of chi. Because what you described, Michael, is beautiful. You know, it really is a healing energy at its essence. But that healing can also be turned to harm if the intent behind it is not pure. I don't know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, as I mentioned, these rogue super soldiers, these berserkers, I've toyed with calling them the Twisted, but they're kind of an embodiment of that.
Now, are those guys from Captain Shaw and Matt Jones?
They're kind of failed experiments.
But their leash is held by those guys, or no?
Not so far, no. They're kind of rogue agents.
Who's their leader?
They don't really have one. What they do have is a hunger. So because of how they were experimented on, they don't have an actual true tap into the source. They use it from kind of their own you know, energy reserves, but it depletes. And these guys, they burn up that reserve in themselves, and they have to fill it back up again. And they do it by, you know, feeding off of others' energy.
One last quick question, then I'll turn it back over to Nathan. So there's science that's being applied to these guys, some treatment or alteration that's being done to them that allows them to tap chi?
Yeah, that's what they've been experimenting with, because they found out about chi and they haven't been able to obtain a legitimate source, a true adept, and so that's why they want to find a candidate. But they've been experimenting with drug cocktails, you know, subliminal conditioning, all these types of things to have them be able to use it.
Okay.
All they can do is tap into their own inner reserve. They can't tap into the source, which is really kind of this main ball of energy that comes from the Earth's core.
Gotcha. Okay. Nathan, character arcs. Benny, Laura, Shun, Shaw, Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, that last little bit was, if it were me, and I know it's not, I would not have these guys be vampires.
Yeah, they sound like vampires.
They do. They really do.
What you did is you made vampires. It's just that they're not sucking blood. They're sucking chi. And if it becomes a vampire story real fast.
Yeah.
And it's not a vampire story. It's a zombie story. And either way, no. Personally, I think the whole medical experimentation, having somebody hold their leash, that's much more powerful. And that gives you the opportunity to actually set up direct conflict rather than what you established, which is sort of an environmental conflict. Mm-hmm. Jack, Benny is not, in the way that you've laid it out here, Benny isn't trying to fight to get through or get past or get by. He's trying to survive the storm.
Right.
And so by setting them up as failed experiments, basically wandered off from some government thing, you know, there's more questions there than answers.
Yeah.
And you're going to need to have some answers for that. I think putting them on somebody's leash, whether it's Matt, what was it, Matt Jones? No, he was his manager.
Right.
Military handler Jack
Captain
Shaw.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if Shaw is set up right as the, you know, the guy behind pulling the strings, you don't really have to show too much of him. You can just sort of show his effect through his little minions.
Mm-hmm.
And then these people who haven't got a true tap, but sort of this sort of perverted version of it, who work for Jack Shaw, because Jack Shaw will give them their next fix, which lets them continue in their feeling of power.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got a very real kind of power dynamic with Shaw and his minions, and Shun and his sort of network of agents.
Yeah.
And Now you've kind of created this sort of interlocked world that this interlocked net that Benny Parker and Laura Acevedo have to navigate in order to survive, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that becomes your first arc. Now, I did like that we touched it at the end and become a beacon for one shining moment. That actually could work. You know, I could see this as like, you know, act one of like a much bigger arc. And so that little beacon, that little shiny moment thing at the end, okay, I'm good with now. We're going to, you know, that's going to have an implication on an interdimensional level that we can explore that in the next story. I'm good with that.
Yeah.
But this, and that makes this a very nice, neat little thing. With a rabbit hole at the end, you can go down.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Because one of the things about writing series that I discovered almost inadvertently is that one of the things that you can't do is tie everything off. You have to leave loose ends, And part of the loose end leaving is, I have no idea where this is going to go, but I'm going to throw this end off here and let it sort of sit there. And somewhere 3 books from now, I'm going to need something, and it's going to be that end that I left hanging. And you really can't predict which end is going to leave, which end is going to matter, which end is going to use. You just sort of have to, and we talked about this on the 20 Minutes with, you have to trust. You have to trust that the story that you're telling, your mind knows what you're doing even if your brain doesn't know what you're doing. and that the story itself will have an internal consistency if you let it have its own consistency. And part of this workshopping is really kind of playing with ideas that might govern that internal consistency.
Sure.
Now, I did have a couple of questions. One is interface between Act 1 and Act 2. There has to be a door there. It has to be a one-way door. So when you were laying this out originally, I thought the one-way door was he killed the guy. But the way you've outlined it now, it sounds like the door is, do I go with Laura or not? And, of course, he has to go, because if he doesn't go to the story ends. But he has to go. And once he goes, he can't go back. And so part of your challenge in Act 1 is going to be to set that up in such a way so that if he goes with Laura, he's taking the blue pill. He can't go back.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And then Act 3, the junction between Act 2 and Act 3, it kind of was sort of like, well, and then magic happens, and then they have a fight. And so what I'm looking for here, and you don't necessarily need to come up with it right now, I don't think, but I think you really need to be aware that there needs to be a likewise a one-way door that takes you out of Act 2 and into Act 3, so that once you finish with the build and they approach the final battle, win or lose, they're not going to go back.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
Well, and one of the things that struck me as you were presenting the pitch, you know, in Act 3, Shun comes out of hiding, right?
Right.
Right. What if that was the plan all along? What if Captain Shaw and Matt Jones Captain Shaw and his organization have been wanting Shun for years because he has secrets, he has mastery, whatever, and the whole game of pursuing Benny and keeping the pressure up on him and so on and so forth was all a ruse to bring Shun out, because that's the real end game.
Right, because in the beginning, Benny is really a small fish.
Right, and it continues to be, I think. You know, going back to Nathan's concept of ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, one of the things that struck me that was this notion of Captain Shaw's organization's ethics and morals and conception of chi as a tool, as a weapon, as a weapon of defense, sure, but a weapon. They have their own moral structures, and you can evolve that. Shun and the Keepers of Chi have their own other framework of ethics and morals and so on. What if Benny's path is... what if both of them are wrong? What if the Keepers of Chi and Shaw are wrong, and Benny's the one who is to heal that rift? You talked about healing, the healing power of chi. What if Shun has been so long removed from the flow of life that he's blinded by chi and doesn't understand what it means to be human anymore? And now Benny is almost the messiah. He's the one who can mend this rift that has been growing for thousands of years.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned that, Dave, because I do see... the Keeper's path as being too rigid.
Yeah.
You know, their you know, ideas, let's just find everyone who can do this, let's teach them how to control it, and then let's all just sit here in the temple and make sure that no one messes with
contemplate
us.
Contemplate our navels, right.
Contemplate our navels, yes, exactly. Meditate upon the world.
Yeah, okay. Good.
And, of course, you know, Shaw, you know, and his idea is, no, this is something that we need as a weapon, as a military tool.
Sure, sure. So to protect people, you know.
Right, exactly.
He's a perfectly motivated antagonist.
Right.
Brian, what else you got, man? I know you've got other stuff in that seething cauldron that you call ahead.
Oh, I'm digging everything you guys are laying down. I'm totally there with you. And I agree about basically everything that you just said, Dave. One of the things that I think I would like to see, just because I love to see tight, you know, nice little tight packages. Well, that sounds really good. I like to see things wrapped up the right way. I was looking back and I think that the guy that he kills inadvertently, in the match or whatever, that needs to be a setup. There needs to be.
Oh, I don't know. You think?
Well, I think if
why
I what I'm feeling is that he knows less about who he is than the people who are wanting to use him, and that's sort of a culminating event. It's a catalyst, and it's a catalyst for his internal conflict. And if it matches up with the external conflict, but not until later, when we find out that, you know, that it was something that was set up from the beginning to set him on a particular course, with this end result in mind, then that just brings in a whole new set of internal conflict in terms of what every decision that I've been making along the way has been forced, and what control do I really have?
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I can see that.
Yeah, that makes sense. With who knows about Benny, it's basically the Keepers, and that's because of Shun. Shun's mastery gives him the ability to kind of like Xavier in the X-Men.
Sure, he can sense the chi arising in an individual and then send his agents like Laura out to align with them and guide them.
Right, exactly.
That force is strong in this one.
Yeah. Well, that's what I've been feeling the whole time, is kind of a congruency with the force.
There really is, and Shaw's the dark side. I mean, Shaw is nurturing those angry, fearful, defensive emotions that draw on chi, or the force, or whatever you want to call it. And I don't think when you were mentioning that, Mike, I was thinking, and I was going down this line of, ooh, we could have corruptors of the chi, so we got the light and the dark side. And it's like, do we want to be afraid of that? I don't think so. As long as it doesn't become a blatant rehashing of Star Wars, and it doesn't sound like that at all.
Right.
I don't think there's a danger in the notion of the corruption of life force or the exalting of it.
I can promise you one thing, Dave. There will be no midichlorians popping up. Good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Holy crap, Nathan. No, what do you think?
Good.
Okay. I'm really liking this. Something that we went by here about 4 minutes ago was Shun being cut off from the world.
Yeah.
What if, to use your famous words, what if one of the reasons that Shun is willing to come out is because over his lifetime he's noticed a diminution of chi, of it fading, and that he needs to find some new construct or some new practitioner that can bring new life into their practice. And the fact that they're cut off from the world, that act of cutting themselves off to protect themselves actually is choking off their ability to garner and foster chi. And Benny, because he is in the world, is one of the people who has the balance between being able to foster it and control it and grow it, even though he doesn't understand what it is.
Sure. And this whole drama that is unfolding is really a tipping point, a crisis point for chi and the life force and the world.
And the world. And then you don't need interdimensional beings to save the world, because it's whether or not we can keep chi alive.
Sure.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you can draw parallels to, you know, the anger and the fear that's being mongered and evolved in the world as, you know, a response to chi, to these corruptors who have fostered and nurtured that.
And then you have Ghostbusters too.
Yeah. There you go.
And I think you can really, really lean heavily on this idea of light and dark, of yin and yang, if you go to void, because if you go back and look at the Book of Five Rings, Earth, Air, Fire, Water, Void, it's only in the void that things have meaning, and good and bad can't exist by themselves. Light and dark can't exist by themselves, because if there's only light, there is no dark. There is no there is no shift. There is no chi. There is no movement.
Which makes Benny a perfect vessel for that channel, because he's anything but void. He's the very embodiment of these two polar things of nonviolence and violence.
Yep. Oh, I love that.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's
so he needs to come to grip. And I was going to say, you know, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And his choice, we'll see how it goes. I was going to say, Mike, at the beginning, I'd like to see Benny, you know, maybe in an opening scene, just to build a little drama, to have Benny training and actually being in the same gym or whatever with his adversary for the fight that's coming up that night, and have them be friends, have them be, you know, adversaries, but adversaries in the way of, we are both masters of our craft. I respect you and I like you. I'm going to kick your ass tonight, but we're still buds, which makes Benny's killing of him by accident that much more traumatic and that much more a complete violation of everything that he holds to up to this point in his life.
That is perfect, because, you know, that's completely how Benny is. You know, he would compete against a friend, a training partner, because in sport, in competition, you have to do that sometimes. This isn't teams. This is an individual sport. But it's all about, for him, respect for his opponent, respect for their martial arts, respect for the act of testing each other.
And then he violates that. That's a wonderful character goad at that point. That pushes him out of the zone. Guys, I'm looking at the time ticking down, so I need to move us into that final stage where we take one more lap around the table and give any final thoughts or ideas that we hadn't gotten out. I know Michael was looking for insights into chi magic and questions about the romance with Laura. So if we can touch on those just briefly as we go around, that would be awesome. Nathan, we'll start off with you. Final thoughts for Mike.
I really like the way this is shaking loose. I really like the idea of having Shun and Shaw be counterpoints, counter forces. In this conflict, and having Benny be the fulcrum, the question then becomes, what is Laura? And it goes back to your idea of having her be a girlfriend who's also a spy. Is there a stronger role in there for her? Can she be something besides a pawn?
Maybe she's his trainer.
I got Matt Jones being the trainer.
Well, Matt Jones was his fight manager, and that's not always the same.
That's true. Maybe she could be his trainer. I don't know. But one of the things that I think you want to watch out for is the arm candy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
She needs to have a role here, and we haven't really talked about what that role might be. We've got Shun, we've got Shaw. In the classic story, the hero has a helper who is usually wiser, frequently older. That's the Obi-Wan Kenobi character, is the Yoda character. Mm-hmm. It's not always that way, but quite frequently there is a helper.
So she's kind of his foil.
Yeah, in a way she's his foil. She could be, she's an agent of Shun, the way that you've laid this out, right?
Correct.
As an agent of Shun, maybe she is the trainer. Maybe she runs the school.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's doable.
And I don't know, the romance part, that's a toughie. How much of the romance that you want to put into it. You have to be careful not to call it a romance, because a romance needs particular things in order to work. You can add romantic elements, but be careful of romance. Romance readers are vicious.
Yeah.
Right.
Excellent. Brian, final thoughts.
Oh, I'm conflicted. I think she, let me just lay this out for a second and I'll think out loud. I keep coming back to her being a reporter, but that just sounds so like overdone with, we need a strong female character. Let's make her a reporter. You know what I mean? There's got to be something else for her. And Trainer just doesn't feel right. It feels too easy almost. I don't know. But I definitely, I'd like to see her almost as a contagonist. You know, as somebody that is continually trying to help him and putting him in situations seemingly inadvertently that make things harder for him, but in the long run are purposeful. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I see with her, and bringing her into that, you know, she has this bigger role. She has a strong motivation for the things that she's doing, and she does love him, which conflicts with what she feels her ultimate duty is. What that really looks like, I have no idea, and that's where my brain is kind of splitting. But go ahead.
I got it.
Okay, do it. Now, do it, Dave.
I'm gonna say Trainer actually works beautifully for me, because what better way for Chun's agents to integrate and cultivate the Chi warriors in the world other than having somebody actually train them discreetly, surreptitiously, without their knowledge, in preparing them for Chi? And so if Laura is his trainer, then his burst of power that kills his friend is her fault. Ooh. Because she did it wrong.
Okay.
Or she did it right and it got out of hand.
Right. Yes, exactly. Either way, there's a responsibility there that she feels.
Sure.
I would keep, you know, I know you have her saying, "Hi, I'm from the Keepers of Chi. Come with me and I'll save you." I would say, no, don't do that. You know, he kills somebody, they run back to the training room, and it's like, okay, here are your deals, she says. You can run, you can stay here and go to jail for murder, or you can run. You choose, I will back your play, whichever way you go. He has to choose to run. He will not force her and push her in any direction. And he's, of course, completely frazzled and on the edge and feral. Fight or flight takes over. He runs. Now, during the course of Act 1 and even into Act 2, you have them kind of randomly going and fleeing and trying to get to it back to the temple. What if Laura is guiding him? She realizes she screwed up, didn't train him well, but this adventure, and I use that in heavy air quotes, that they're on, can be an opportunity for her to make it right. And so she guides him through a series of, I'm going to say tests. That sounds a little contrived, but it could be a series of events that guide him to make the choices he needs to make to be his own person and come into his own chi. In Act 2, everything that she is working towards to get him to this point where, you know, he can get to Tibet or whatever, Shaw comes in and it all goes to hell. Everything is doomed. They're screwed. They're totally hosed. Oh my God, what's going to happen? And then at the end of Act 2, Shun shows up. And now for the first time, we get a glimpse, and now her role is betrayed. Now we see, oh crap, now you're the betrayer. Because he was probably having feelings for her during the course of this run. They're both, you know, on the run, they're on the land, they're going through fights and dealing with all this conflict. So there's this strong emotional bond. And then now her betrayal is that much more profound. And now Benny's got something to deal with. And how you get him through that, I have no fucking idea. But, oh, baby, take him to the height, and then now Shun comes in, and now it's a whole different ballgame. And now Act 3 is the positioning of the players for the final conflict, the revelation of Benny's ultimate role in the ensuing drama and the choice he has to make.
Yeah, I like a lot of that, Dave. You know, the reason for running, though, They wouldn't run because he's going to go to jail. It's not murder when an accidental death happens in,
right.
You know,
Oh, okay.
So
all right.
That wouldn't happen. But going back to Nathan's recommendation of these berserkers, these twisted being leashed by Shaw, which I now think has to happen, because how else does he find Benny? They're kind of his hound dogs, because they can sense it. But you know, that's the catalyst for running. Maybe she's trying to console him, you know, talk him down from his misery,
salvage his training, because he's off the rails now.
And she doesn't even know they're about to show up, and they're the wild card that throws them, you know, into fight or flight.
Sure.
And then everything you said from then on goes from there.
Sure. Okay. Maybe it's the search for who these deranged beings are, and the revelation of the plot and the dark forces. Blah blah blah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You need one more. You need one more piece. He has to be running to something.
Yes. Good point.
Well, isn't it? You know, running to, learning how to control this, learning how to deal with it, trying to get to Shun.
Well, see, those are two different things, because. Okay. He's at this, when these berserkers come after him, he's in danger, and there has to be only one place that he can go to be safe. And what they try to do for the rest of the book is to get there. Now, the sleight of hand here is that, the place that he needs to be safe is in himself, not a physical place. And the whole time they're looking for this physical place that they're going to go to be safe. And because he's the fulcrum, because he's the focus, he's not going to be safe until he's himself.
Right. Sure, they get to that place, and then Shaw comes in and blows it up or whatever.
Or something, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. But they need it, but she needs to offer him something to run to, otherwise there's no reason for him to run with her.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think. Spitballing, but that seems to me like, you know, you get the good setup, you got the thing, you get the death, you got the thing, you go back to his room, and they go back to the training room, and then these guys come in, and it's like, oh my god, what are we going to do now? How are we going to get away? They escape with their lives, and what's on their back, and where are they going to go? What are they going to do? Well, you can't go home, because they'll be waiting for you there. Now what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And yeah.
So what are we going to do? And Laura has the answer, because Laura knows Shun. Laura knows the temple. Laura knows it's there, because that's where she trained.
Right. There's a place I know. She doesn't have to reveal. She doesn't have to tip her hand.
Yep.
She just needs to say, I know a place.
There's a place I know. Will you trust me?
Yeah.
Well, and that's going to really lead into, you know, his trust issues, because maybe at that point he does, you know, trust her. But then when that final reveal comes, when Shun shows up and you know,
bam,
you know,
yep.
Yes, my student, you have done well. And
what?
He's like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, this has been gold. This is fabulosity. Mike, here's the deal. You write this thing. Oh, please
yes.
Write this thing. And when you do, we will knight you. We will make you a knight of the round table, and we will plaster your picture among the knights of gloriosity who have actually written a story and put it out there for the world to see.
If you need the sword, Dave, I've got it sitting right behind me, so.
Awesome. Yeah, we might take you up on that. We might just take you up on that. Very cool. Michael, thank you so much. This was fabulous. Great story. Wonderful workshopping. I think there's some gold here, and we always appreciate our writers who step up and show the courage and commitment to their craft to workshop their stories. So thank you, sir, very much.
It's a true honor.
You're a gentleman, sir. And speaking of gentlemen, Nathan, thank you so much. Your insights, your contributions, your the vision you brought to this, I think really helped authenticize, sure, why not, the story and kept it on track to being something that I think has good drama, good characters, as you always do. Thank you so much, sir.
Well, thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Us too. Us too.
Excellent.
And as long as we're thanking people, let's by all means thank our listeners who hit that play button time and time again. Whether you tuned in on iTunes, you went to our website, or you went to Stitcher, because now we are available on Stitcher Radio. However you found us, thank you for finding us, and thank you for listening. Spreading the word is always gold to Brian and I. We so appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Ratings and reviews on iTunes, comments, if you have ideas, and I know you do, for Mike's story idea, continue the discussion out on the comment thread for the post, and we'll just keep rocking the chi of the story here, and we will all be story fingers. So, Brian, closing thoughts, man. What are you thinking?
I'm worn out, because this was one of those that it just is so in my brain at the moment that I don't even know what I'm not gonna get any sleep tonight. So
yeah,
it's fabulous. It's so cool. So yeah. Mike, definitely get this thing written and in my hands. and Nate, I'm really excited to work with you tomorrow. So thanks for coming on tonight. And I think it's awesome, and we always get gold every time that we talk to you. So.
Thanks.
Yep, absolutely. All right, friends, just when you thought it couldn't get any better, in a few days, we're going to start this all over again. New guest hosts, new guest writers, more awesomeness, literary gold, and writerly goodness abounding. But that's a few days from now. So between now and then, we always have a couple of suggestions on what you might like to do.
That's right.
Brian?
Go write.
Go write. Go look for awesomeness, because you find what you're looking for. Friends, we will talk to you again soon. Until then, stay frosty, be awesome, and we are looking forward to the next time we can workshop together.
Absolutely.
Until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com, or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.